Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Math, not the favorite subject for most people. If it gave you stress in school, you are definitely not alone. And even as an adult, a lot of people shy away from numbers, which is detrimental to getting a handle on your money. It's kind of not the best thing. Vanessa Vicaria says math doesn't have to be so scary. She is the CEO and founder of The Math Guru. It is a tutoring studio for kids and adults. And she's going to be here to tell us about her latest book, Math Hacks 2. Building good credit can differ from country to country. And so it can be challenging for new immigrants to understand how credit works here and also make sure that they do the right things to build good credit. Enoch Omololu from Savvy New Canadians will be here to share his tips for newcomers to help them get on the right track. And looking to build a portfolio but have no idea where to start? Portfolio manager Dan Bortolotti 100% can help. He's written a book called Reboot Your Portfolio. It is based on his extensive experience writing the couch potato portfolio. So he's got a lot of insight on passive investing and indexing and successfully investing in exchange-traded funds. Then we're going to get talking about your house, financing your house for the first time or the fifth time. Should you use a mortgage broker? Big question for people. Jacob Perez is a partner and mortgage agent at Synergy Mortgage Group. He's going to be here to talk about how to get the most out of that relationship. Plus, how commission-free trading brokerages like Robinhood make their money and how that can impact the investing experience. Personal finance expert Preet Banerjee will be here to share some of the behind the scenes on how the sausage gets made. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Math matters. It matters. It mattered in school, and it matters for grown-ups too, because it is a piece of the puzzle in getting a handle on your money, which is why we're talking to a math tutor, but not just any math tutor. No, not just any math tutor. Vanessa Vicaria is the founder and CEO of The Math Guru, and she is here to talk about her second book, not first, but second book called Math Hacks 2. Stress less and do better. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hello, everyone. Math matters. I love it.
Math Hacks 2. It's like an Avengers sequel, like Avengers 2. Was that what you were going for, given that our young people are so used to sequels?
I love that you brought that up. I was actually thinking more like Matrix 2, but Avengers, I think, is probably more relatable to the younger generation.
It is. You're dating yourself as soon as you say The Matrix, but that's okay. That's okay. You're still young at heart. You're young and groovy. Tell me first off, how would you articulate your philosophy about math? Because some of our listeners would have a disempowered view of it. It would be something like, you know, the science invented to terrorize my soul. That is not how you would describe it.
I would absolutely not describe it that way, but I want to say for anyone who is having that visceral reaction right now, I totally understand. I failed grade 11 math twice. I also thought it was the science invented to torture my soul until I discovered that it was the greatest gift in that it is a tool to enable us all to make sense of the world in ways that are meaningful to us. That is what it is. And we can all do it. I promise you.
You've written two books. As a second book, you have a podcast called Math Therapy. You run a tutoring studio with many, many tutors and many, many more students every single week. What have you learned about the fundamental issue of why people struggle? They struggle with this in a way that they don't struggle in other ways in our culture.
Okay. I love that you asked this question because it's something I've actually been talking and thinking about all week. And I've boiled it down to two things. Because, I mean, there's obviously not just one answer, but I will say this. I think there are two things about math that make it particularly hard to digest for most. And I'm saying most, not some, for most people. So again, if you're one of those people, you are most people. The first thing is that we are so obsessed with the right answer in math that it becomes about being being scared of failure, not even math. Mm. Those people who are scared of math are scared of getting it wrong, of being publicly wrong, of being embarrassed. So once you pause on that and say, hold on a second. Yes, getting the correct solution is a very important part of math, but not the only part of math. Things change. And that brings me to point number two, which is we need to stop defining being good at math as A, getting the right answer all the time. B, being able to do math really quickly in your head. C, being like Matt Damon from Good Will Hunting. None of those things are the things that make you good at math. You are good at math if you are creative in solving problems, if you are spotting trends and patterns before anyone else, if you are packing the car trunk in this amazingly efficient way, like if you can find a different solution to a problem that someone hasn't thought of. There are so many ways to be good at math. And once you broaden that scope for people, I think more people can identify with being mathematically capable.
It is also the connection to the reason why we have our young people study math, right? Because none of the equations are going to be useful for anyone but the most hardcore engineers out there. But all of us need the sort of scaffolding that is built by the pedagogy.
Absolutely. And you know what? You and I talked about this earlier about how really the math most adults need, especially when it comes to money, okay? The math most of us need are really like grade 6, 7, 8-ish concepts, like percentages, you know, like an understanding of decimals, an understanding of what a 30% more than means. And that's why I say I promise you everyone can do it. It's about finding how you connect to those concepts. But if you're like, you know what? I was good at math until X's were introduced. Pause. You were good at math. Pause on that. That's it. Don't even say the second part because you are good at math.
What I love about this second book is you have an entire section called Confidence Hacks. You are awesome. Don't you forget it is how that chapter begins. Talk about some of these tips, some of them, and the way it's art directed is so on point and beautifully done for either young people or grownups with a sense of whimsy. Tell me how one can hack the confidence part of the equation.
Okay. So I will say this, both of the books, I placed a large emphasis on putting in like 30 to 40 pages of these hacks that are not actual math, but they're about the context in which you are learning math. So stuff like confidence, motivation, what to do when you're feeling anxious. I think we don't realize that that is such an intricately intertwined part of the math learning process. We can't just hand someone a book with a bunch of fractions in it and say, go. You need next to those fractions to be able to flip to a page that says, what happens when I'm panicking about fractions? So when we talk about confidence, so much of being scared of math or feeling like you're not good at math really is about that confidence piece. It's about being able to talk to yourself like you would talk to a best friend. So if your best friend like made a math mistake, would you say, oh, you're such an idiot. You're never going to be good at math. No, you'd probably be like, okay, you made a mistake, but I actually really like what you did there. Why don't you try again? So how do we learn to talk to ourselves that way? Because guess what? Just like riding a bike, you're not going to get it the first time you try to learn it. It takes practice. It doesn't mean you'll never get it, but you have to be able to pep talk yourself along the way.
Yeah, you've got some very specific ideas around mantra magic and making a superstar spread, some very, very helpful and practical things. There's also these chill out hacks. Mm-hmm. I relax, it's only math. That must be hard to apply the night before you've got a big exam.
Okay, so we're not going to get into the whole story now. I know we're in a time crunch, but you might famously remember when I famously got the answer to 4 minus 3 wrong on national television when I was on the show Canada's Smartest Person.
Yes.
I panicked. I did not use any chill out hacks and I completely blanked. And so I think that whole section and my approach to math has come from moments like that where I've realized, I mean, hopefully you believe I know what 4 minus 3 is, right? Like, often the anxiety and panic around math, around being embarrassed, around getting it wrong, supersedes our math knowledge and our ability to learn math. So we really need to be able to do things like chill out, learn how to do a body scan, learn how to deep breathe, learn how to make a list of things that you're actually scared of so you can see whether or not they're realistic. You know, like we need all of those tools in our toolkit in order for us to build a healthy relationship with math.
Including a technique that involves the image of a big red balloon. What should we do there?
The big red balloon, really, really love that. Okay, so big red balloon technique is really about breathing. So it's about actually using, I think often we're talking about breathing and in and out and it seems so vague, but the big red balloon technique involves you actually doing a visualization of a balloon slowly filling up with air, slowly floating. I honestly can't actually remember because I wrote it so long ago and I haven't revisited it. So am I right? Is that
what I've got it in front of me. That's exactly what it says. Okay. Yes.
That's what I kind of remember because I'm thinking of the visualizations I do when I'm breathing, and kids really latch on to being able to say, okay, breathe in, fill up your stomach like it's a big red balloon, then slowly deflate it, and doing that repeatedly. So there's a visual to go along with it. And you kind of like feel those sensations in your stomach as though they're a balloon. I use balloon because it really resonates with kids. But the thing is, I think it's a little less vague than just telling adults to breathe too, right? Yeah. So any technique like that where you can actually turn mindfulness into something super practical, super fast, and super visual is really important.
Be a thought detective. You want to catch your thoughts. You want to collect evidence. You want to challenge your thoughts. This is almost like a riff on traditional cognitive behavior therapy. In fact, it's not a riff. It is CBT.
I am so glad you brought that up because I'll tell you, I actually, 2 years ago, I think maybe three, saw my first therapist, and she was a CBT therapist. And I felt like even after I, you know, kind of didn't need to see her anymore, I was like, I'm just going to keep going back because these are really useful skills for me to use with my students. And I started doing it. I actually started experimenting in the studio when I had anxious kids, giving them skills like be a thought detective, making them, you know, text me lists they'd written out of their thought cycle and how it had started and how it had ended. Like, you know, it starts with, I'm so panicked, I can't write my test, I'm going to fail. And I would say, and then what? Well, my parents are going to be mad. And then what? Well, I'll never get into a university. And slowly along the line, I'd be like, is that realistic? And they'd be like, I guess not.
I guess not. But there's this dragon that's going to come eat me in my bed. Is that? Oh, no. Oh, no. I've made that part up too. Oh, oops.
I love that you pointed that out and you noticed that because it is, you know, we are using actual CBT and DBT sometimes techniques in these actual tangible skills.
Okay, one other section I want to reference. We've only got about a minute left. You've got memory hacks. What is your single best, your single most effective memory hack as it relates to math?
Okay, honestly, so I always loved memorizing. So I love all, and I like patterns. So when it comes to, let's say, the times tables, I like things like patterns. But I'm going to tell you this. My favorite hack is to change the lyrics of your favorite song. That's it.
Wow.
Change the lyrics of your favorite song to be whatever you need to remember. It'll get stuck in your head. It'll be so annoying. You'll never forget it.
Oh my gosh. And what's your favorite song?
Well, right now I feel like it's Brutal by Olivia Rodrigo. So like, I feel like Olivia Rodrigo songs are really like easy to change lyrics to. Same with Taylor Swift. But I mean, over the summer, I remember we taught this whole lesson about Sokotoa, which is like angles, whatever. We don't need to get into it. But we changed the words to an Olivia Rodrigo song that was viral on TikTok and posted it on Instagram and literally was stuck in my head for a month.
Genius. As soon as you bring in the Broadway musical theater canon, then I will be rocking grade 10 math once again.
Oh my God. Imagine Hamilton, but math.
Oh yeah. Hamilton, but math. There's your next book, Vanessa. It all began here. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for crystallizing the idea of Math Hacks 3 on Moolala. It is a delight anytime I get to be in your presence.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much. You're the best.
Vanessa Vaccari is the founder and CEO of The Math Guru. Her second book is called Math Hacks 2.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Building a diversified investment portfolio is easy. It's actually easy. People think it's hard. It's easy. It's called indexing, and it is easy and has been easy for years and years and years. It's just that a lot of people don't know how to do it, or they can't quite wrap their mind around the fact that it is really so straightforward. Dan Bortolotti is a portfolio manager of PWL Capital. He is also the blogger behind the Couch Potato Portfolio. And he has a new book. It is called Reboot Your Portfolio. He joins me now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Why are we still talking about this? You and I have been talking about this for literally a decade. You have run the blog for more than a decade. Surely a part of you was like, who's going to read this book? Surely everybody knows this already.
Well, it's funny that you put it that way because, you know, when I launched the blog over 10 years ago now, all of the problems were different. I mean, back then it wasn't really that easy to put together a portfolio because you had to know which individual funds to pick and, you know, what proportion to include in your portfolio of each of those funds. And so it was a little bit tricky. Over the last 10 years or so, there have been new products that have been released that have made it easier than ever. But I think for many people, it has, you know, just made it easier for them to implement their own portfolio. But there are still different challenges out there, and a lot of them are just behavioral. I mean, I talk to people all the time who say, this sounds way too simple. What am I missing? And I have to tell them, you're not missing anything. I mean, it really is that simple if you can bring yourself to do it.
Yeah. It's like breakfast for dinner. It's really simple and quite delicious as well. I love a good breakfast for dinner. How did you personally let go of the idea that successful investing was about beating the market? Was that a hard paradigm for you to break for yourself?
I think it's hard for everybody when they first hear about it. I mean, we were all brought up, and certainly advisors are brought up, but even individuals, you know, are brought up investing. It's about picking stocks. It's about forecasting the economy, knowing when to get in and when to get out. It happened for me about 12 years ago at an event that I was at that, you know, people explain this basic idea that, you know, you don't need to beat the market. All you need to do is harness what the market has to offer and keep your costs as low as possible. And that is not only going to be enough because there's this idea that, you know, it's average, it's mediocre. Not at all. It's the opposite. If you're just able to do that over an investing lifetime, you're likely to be in the top 10, 15% of all investors.
That program that you attended, which you write about in the book, became this blog that's been around for a long period of time and a strategy, the couch potato strategy. You say that there is a challenge with that phrase or it's a metaphor that doesn't work entirely. What do you mean?
So it is a term that I've come to regret over the years. I mean, I should say it's not a term I invented, but it's one I kind of appropriated.
Nice.
The problem with it is it makes it sound like if you use this strategy, you're lazy, you're not very thoughtful, you haven't put a whole lot of effort or consideration into what goes into your portfolio, you don't really care, and so you're willing to settle for this kind of, you know, good enough idea. Right. And the problem with that is that, you know, the strategy is in fact very sophisticated. It's based on decades of academic research. It's used by institutional investors, pension funds, things like that. It's embraced by Nobel Prize winners. So it is not at all an unsophisticated strategy. It's just that it's not that difficult to implement. We were trying to make investing less intimidating for people with that moniker. But I feel in some ways it's backfired and a lot of smart people think they're too smart for this strategy.
Right. You could go back and rebrand it KISS, keep it simple, stupid. That would work. Now we have these robo-advisors, which as you say, they weren't around a decade ago. Mm-hmm. When the amounts are smaller, when people are just getting started, is the robo path a good option, do you think?
I think it can be for sure. I mean, you know, the robo-advisor option, the one thing that it is lacking is that human contact and the, you know, big picture financial planning. But a lot of young investors, especially who are just in that accumulation stage, they don't really need that. Mm-hmm. And so if really what you're looking for is something to automate your savings, which is really important, you know, just get a few hundred dollars in there every month and not worry about, you know, trying to time the market, just focus on regular savings. And if you don't want to be bothered with the idea of understanding how to construct a properly diversified portfolio, they do all of that for you. And the fees are very reasonable, especially when you have a relatively small account. I always remind people to look at the dollar amount of the fees and not just the percentage. And for a small portfolio, you don't have to go for the absolute cheapest option.
Right. In your book, Reboot Your Portfolio, you really go through the who, what, when, where, why, and how. It's very specific, very, very clear. You've got one section called stuff you don't need. And I did a control F in the PDF of the book. I didn't see crypto mentioned once. Maybe I spelt it wrong. What's on the list of stuff you don't need in your portfolio?
You know, it's well, crypto is definitely at the top of that list, although I didn't include it in the book because if you've made it that far through my book, you would have known that crypto wasn't even worth talking about
right.
for me. But what I was trying to focus on there is that, you know, in the olden days, index funds and ETFs used to just be plain vanilla portfolios of stocks and bonds. Now there's all kinds of exotic products and unusual asset classes. And, you know, these include things like, you know, corporate bonds, as opposed to just safer government bonds, preferred shares, other kinds of equity strategies that are just a little bit more advanced and fancy sounding that make it seem like your portfolio is more sophisticated, but mostly it's just noise and it adds complexity and costs that you don't need.
We will have a market correction. We don't know when, but we will have one. You lived through 2008. I did too. What is the couch potato way to live through the next one?
Well, the most important thing to remember about that is, you know, if and when the crash comes, as an index investor, you're going to suffer too, right? I mean, index investing does not offer you any protection against losses in the market. So, you know, if your funds track the overall index and it falls 30%, your fund is going to fall 30% too. So you need to be aware of that, and you have to free yourself from this illusion that indexing is inherently less risky in the sense that it's still exposed to the market. But if and when that happens, then the correct strategy is to rebalance your portfolio. So that means that if stocks have fallen, you're selling your bonds, which have gone up, and buying more stocks when they've been beaten down. And it works the other way around too. After a 2-3 year bull market, your stocks are likely to be way overweighted. So you're going to sell some stocks and buy some bonds. And that's the way you control the risk in the portfolio.
You talk about some of the pitfalls or biases that can affect our ability to execute on this strategy. One is the action bias or the urge to do something. I just want to do something. It's called passive investing for a reason, but we don't like being passive. How do you help people work through that?
Well, that's exactly right. I think that the whole notion of being passive or sitting on our hands sort of is something that we don't embrace in other aspects of our lives, right? I mean, if we want to get good at something, we think we should be doing more, we should be practicing it, right? We should put a lot more effort into it. But investing can often be the other way around. And like the less, this is assuming that you've set up the portfolio properly in the first place, the less you touch it, the better. And so this is one of the biases that people have, especially with the new all-in-one portfolio products that are available now. You can purchase a diversified portfolio just in a single product. But then the goal is you just leave it alone. And it's so difficult for people to do that. They feel like, but shouldn't I be doing something, right? If the market has just gone down, or I think it's going to go down, shouldn't I reposition in order to take advantage or avoid the risk? And the answer is just no, stick to your plan.
Just before we go here, you've been writing about this for years and years under the couch potato name, but you're also a portfolio manager. I didn't think people needed advice. How do you justify your professional existence?
Well, I always joke to people, I work some pretty long hours for a guy who doesn't do very much. I think that what you realize is when you get into this industry is that the portfolio construction and, you know, the choosing the right funds, that's the easy part. The difficult part is doing the ongoing planning for clients. And that includes, you know, some of the more technical things, but also just the behavioral coaching, encouraging people to save, encouraging people to stick to their plan when they get nervous, and all sorts of, you know, administrative things that we do for clients that don't have anything to do with picking stocks or timing the market. There's a lot of value we can add doing things other than that.
The book is called Reboot Your Portfolio. And if you've been thinking about passive investing or indexing, it really is a one-stop shop. Dan, you've done a great job. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Dan Bortolotti is a portfolio manager of PWL Capital. He's been writing the Couch Potato Portfolio blog for years and years and years. His book is called Reboot Your Portfolio. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, good credit is built on history. But what if you don't have any? Tips for new immigrants to Canada on building good credit. Our guest is Enoch Omololu from Savvy New Canadians. And later, what you need to know about selling order flow. What does that even mean? Selling order flow. Personal finance expert Preet Banerjee will be here. If you have missed an episode of this program, it's very, very simple to catch up. You can do that on moolala.ca. Search episodes by name or topic or listen to the whole thing. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, whatever it is, and download the show while you're there. Leave us a review, maybe subscribe to the next episode.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Immigrants to Canada sometimes have a lot to pack prior to their move, and that's if they have the luxury of money and time. Sometimes that is not the case. Regardless, they can't easily pack their credit history, right? And that can have a big impact as they try to set up a new life here in Canada, a new financial life here in Canada. Enoch Omololu is the founder of personal finance website Savvy New Canadians, and he joins us now to give us some tips on how new immigrants can build their credit. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
When I moved to the US years ago, I could not get a credit card. What is the reality today for immigrants when they come to Canada as it relates to credit and credit cards?
Yeah, so when I actually arrived in Canada in 2011 as a student, I was able to get a credit card, but it was a secured credit card. So that means I had to put down a deposit in a GIC, and then I got the limit, the same limit for my credit card. So that was the case then. But these days, I believe there are many banks that actually have programs designed for newcomers in particular, and those programs make it easier for newcomers to apply for credit cards through those programs. And in some cases, it's secured. In some cases, it's a regular credit card.
For the regular credit cards, I assume they need some credit history, right? Some of which would be hard to bring across the border depending on where you're coming from. And I say that because I imagine that the level of sophistication on credit scores in the UK is different than if you're coming from, say, Syria or Afghanistan, where there's just a whole bunch of tumult in those geographies. What's your sense for how much of that can travel with you?
So, no, you actually made a very, very good point. Excuse me. So when I check my credit score initially, I had no credit history. And that's because in Nigeria, back when I traveled, there was nothing like credit scores. I mean, there were credit cards, but nothing like credit scores in particular that you could potentially transfer and use elsewhere. So, like you said, let's say you're coming from the UK, it's possible, even from South Africa, for example, it's possible for you to move along some of those that credit history and potentially use it as a leverage when starting out. But it's tougher than just you getting your credit score built here in Canada. So it's a lot tougher. Different banks have different factors they look at, different programs. In some cases, you may be lucky, you get a regular credit card. In some cases, you just have to start from scratch.
Well, we talked about the big banks here. You go on the websites and they are spending a ton of marketing money on the immigrant demographic. But what's your sense? Are they targeting all immigrants equally, or are they pretty focused on high net worth individuals who are moving here with, you know, investable dollars and the ability to put a big down payment on a house? How broad is their net?
So I think for starters, if you're coming in as a permanent resident, so like right off the bat, you're coming into Canada as a permanent resident, many of these programs would work for you. If you're coming in as an international student, it's a lot tougher. That's because, again, the banks are looking long-term for these programs. They're looking to make money as well. So if you're coming in as a student, how many years are you going to spend? How much resources do you actually have for them to spend that much time trying to curry your business? Maybe not a lot, but permanent residents in general would potentially benefit more from these programs. And again, like you said, the more money you actually have to put down, the more benefits you can access through these programs.
You've written about the best cards, best credit cards for immigrants. You've written about that on your site. How do you define best?
For me, to start, it's going to be what's the combination of rewards versus cost. So when I'm thinking about best, I'm thinking of an entry-level card that has potentially zero fees and rewards. In some cases, you have credit cards with zero fees, but the rewards are really nothing to write home about. They're not really worth your time. So if you have a credit card that has zero fees and reasonable rewards that you actually can earn, so for example, cashback on all purchases or on most purchases, then for me, that's a great credit card, as opposed to earning points that really you are potentially not going to be able to redeem them because it's sort of limited and then you're paying these high fees from the get-go.
If I were to pair you with a newcomer to Canada and I gave you a minute or two to teach that new immigrant the key, the most important things to know about building strong credit here in this country, what would you say?
So I'll start off with how credit scores are calculated. And that's your payment history, your credit utilization ratio, the length of your credit history, the types of credit you have, and how often you are applying for new credits. Mm-hmm. So once they understand that, then by inference, they can interpret that, you know what, if I want to build a good credit score in this country, I need to get credit. Because how do you get a payment history without a credit facility? So without a credit card, there's no payment history. Or credit loan, personal loan, car loan, and the likes. And the second to that would be ensuring that once they have the credit card in place, ensuring they pay their bills on time. It's pretty easy to actually damage your credit score even further by not paying your bills on time, having outstanding payments well beyond the allowed grace period and all of that. So paying those bills on time. And then following that, once they sort of get the hang of using the credit card in and out, then you want to also try and get a mix of credit types. Mm-hmm. Even when you have funds to pay outright, say for a car, for example, I would still take a car loan on a small amount and try to pay it off as soon as possible to decrease the interest fees. But then while you're doing that, you're actually building your credit score because now you have credit card, you have a car loan, you're showing potential lenders that you are good with credit. You're a credit-worthy person.
How do you factor in language and culture to really relevant, even if you come from an English-speaking country coming to Canada? There are so many cultural things that I'm oblivious to. I grew up here, including how an individual relates to authority and relates to institutions based on the political context that you come from. What advice would you have for new Canadians on navigating that part of the credit game?
So for credit in particular, I think I grew up in a home where my mom told me when I was traveling out, she was like, make sure you don't get a credit card. It's going to get you into debt and you're going to be in serious trouble. So while I was in the UK for almost 3 years, I did not even think about credit cards at all. It was always cash in, cash out, my debit card. And then when I came to Canada, I wasn't so interested until I tried to buy a car and I was like, oh, you know what? I can't afford this car outright. Let me go to my bank and get a loan. And they're like, oh, sorry, no, you can't give me a loan.
No score.
And I was like, okay, I should have gotten a credit card from the get-go because then I started reading about how to build a credit score and all of that. So that's some cultural aspects that may play into this is you have that upbringing that tells you, you know what, all kinds of debt are bad. And that doesn't really play out here in Canada. You actually need to take on some debt. And I mean, not many people can afford a home paying everything upfront. So those differences can play a lot into how soon people start to actually build their credit score until they're actually forced to do so.
Yeah. Really important stuff. Enoch, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Enoch Omololu is the founder of personal finance website, Savvy New Canadians. You got to check it out. There's tons of insight on so many of the other elements of personal finance. Really, really helpful for people who are new to Canada and looking to learn how things go.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll talk to personal finance expert Preet Banerjee about Robinhood, not the person, the online brokerage, and how it makes its money, because it's not in ways that you would think. But first, if you are thinking of buying a home, there is lots you should know about the mortgage brokerage business. Jacob Perez is going to take us through that process and things you might not have known. Sign up for our newsletter at moolala.ca. You'll find out every month, once a month, all the stuff that we're doing on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and on this show on SiriusXM. It comes once a month. We don't do anything with your email address except we send you that newsletter once a month.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
There's something like 12,000 mortgage brokers in Canada, 12,000. And while a lot of people just go to their local bank to finance their house purchase, there is a case to be made for a person, a human, who will shop around to different lenders to help you find the best mortgage for you. But how does that all work? What are the pros? What are the cons? How do you make it work for you? Jacob Perez is a partner and mortgage agent at Synergy Mortgage Group. He's here to talk about the process of working with a broker. He's in Hamilton. Hello, Jacob.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Why would a borrower go to a mortgage broker?
Well, the main reason someone would go to a mortgage broker is for options. So a lot of times we're talking about the struggle to buy a house. A lot of people are having challenges qualifying for the large loans needed, given the rise in real estate prices that are happening in the market. The reason you go to a mortgage agent is to see how high you qualify in a purchase at multiple banks versus just one of your own home branch institution, whatever it may be. You know, we had an example the other day where one client qualified to purchase up to $500,000 at TD Canada Trust, but then they qualified to buy up to $700,000 at Scotiabank. So whether you're self-employed or maybe you already own a rental property or two, where you actually qualify or how high you qualify may differ quite a bit from bank to bank.
Can brokers actually get a better rate for the client than if they go directly to the bank?
Yeah. So when it comes to mortgages, there's a lot of attention and focus on interest rate. Usually that's because that's one of the main criteria that people are aware of that exists within a mortgage. In terms of interest rates, overall, it's going to be pretty competitive across the board. So whether you go through a mortgage agent or you go into a branch specifically, I think the rates are going to be pretty competitive. I think where you're going to get the benefit with the mortgage agent is they're going to say, hey, within this 30-page agreement at said major five bank, there's actually a huge financial clause that doesn't exist in this other 30-page agreement that might have the exact same interest rate. So it's not just about getting a better interest rate, which you will be able to find the best product with the mortgage agent, but it's also which product has the best underlying clause that won't make up such big financial impacts later on.
How do you get paid? And how do you think that could influence the mortgages that a broker would recommend to their clients?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the model of how a mortgage agent gets paid is really beneficial to everyone. It's beneficial to us, the mortgage agent. It's also beneficial to the client. So the way we get paid is whichever bank we bring the mortgage to typically pays us a fee for bringing them that mortgage. And that fee is directly tied to the size of the mortgage. So there's not necessarily a benefit to bring the mortgage to Scotiabank versus TD Bank or Meridian Credit Union. It's really just what's the best product for the client. So because there is no large variance in terms of pay, there's no subconscious bias that might creep in the process when it comes to directing our clients to their proper institution.
And that's what, 75 basis points or so, 0.75%?
Depends what kind of lenders you're working with, right? It might be 75 basis points, might be 100 basis points. You know, sometimes they might have specials going on, things like that. But really, it's kind of what's the best product for the client. And when it comes to my clients specifically, a lot of them are real estate investors. So we're trying to find products that are going to allow them to continue to buy over and over. And that usually leads to repeat business.
And that's a one-time commission, correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
Why I think that's relevant for people to understand is it's not like a financial advisor who's carrying your business and they're getting a commission over the course of time. It's a one time. And so our expectations as clients should be relatively low in terms of ongoing service because you're not paid in a way that would encourage you to do that.
Exactly. When it comes to banking and financial products, it's really about finding what is the best fit for you. And banks themselves have different appetites. So where some banks may be really competitive and really aggressive in the mortgage space, 1 year later, their organizational goals may change and they may no longer be the best product for you. So as the banks fluctuate their goals, you want to work with somebody who's on the front line so you can steer you in the correct direction.
There's rate, which is a huge focus, but there's also a whole bunch of other features that you can get. And some lenders have them, some don't, like lump sum repayment and payment vacations and all that. Which ones do you find people actually use?
By far, the most important factor to consider your mortgage outside of the interest rate is the penalty if you break the mortgage early. So there's a lot of talk about renewing your mortgage after 5 years. Well, what we're seeing right now with rising real estate prices is that most people are actually accessing equity in their home a lot sooner than that five-year mark, whether it's to do renovation, invest in another property, maybe even taking some equity, investing it in the stock market specifically. So you want to make sure that you're in a product where the penalty to break, if you ever want to adjust the term of your mortgage, is very low. So it gives you flexibility to take advantage of some of this low interest debt. We have a lot of clients who might go into a variable rate mortgage that has a very advantageous penalty structure. And because it's so inexpensive to break after 1 or 2 years, they might break that variable just to go into an even cheaper variable that comes in the market. So you definitely want to have flexibility so you can access as much equity without hesitation as possible.
Yeah. And just to put some numbers on it, let's say it's a $800,000 mortgage. If you were variable, the penalty would be ballpark what, $1,000? If you were fixed, the ballpark break fee would be what, $1,000?
So this is a great example because we just had a client breaking a five-year fixed rate around $832,000 at a credit union. I'm not going to say the name of it. Their penalty to break this mortgage at the credit union was about $43,000. Okay. So
can you
4 to 4.5% of the balance. Yeah, it's very high on these five-year fixed rates. Whereas if you go on with a variable rate mortgage, it's 3 months of interest payments. So if you calculate out around that 800,000 range, that's looking like around $4,000. So it's about a 10 times difference in penalty cost, whether you're in a fixed product or a variable product. And you'll see a lot of these banks push these five-year fixed products for two reasons. One, they either get to keep you as a client for 5 years, or you do what 6 out of 10 Canadians do and you break your five-year fix and they incur that large penalty revenue. So be careful when you're being steered in a direction where the fixed rates are considered safe, when historically and statistically, they've been actually the opposite of safe.
I have been on a variable rate mortgage my entire life and will continue to be on one until I get rid of all mortgage debt. I recently renegotiated. It saved me about $7,000. I was quite happy about that. But it was me who prompted that discussion, not my broker. Should it have been my broker? Are you monitoring the clients that you have and saying, wait a sec, actually, this could make sense?
Yep, we definitely do. So we essentially have a database of all closed mortgages over the last 4 or 5 years. And essentially when there are better products that come in the market, all we have to really do is filter this database and say, hey, everybody who's on this type of mortgage at this percentage rate or higher would benefit statistically from breaking it and moving into this product. From there, we're going to send out a mass email to about, you know, 100, 200, however many mortgages fit this specific criteria. And we'll drive that conversation for the client. And really, it's just a win-win. Our clients save money. We earn an extra commission through the business. And, you know, if your broker is not doing that stuff, you know, they just might not have as sophisticated systems in place so that they're creating that many win-wins for their clients.
Right. And noted that the broker would collect the fee earlier than the 5 years that mortgage was supposed to last for. So they'd get that 75 basis points a little bit early. That's important to note. There's questionable behavior in all industries, financial services and otherwise. What are some things you've heard brokers do that really are offside?
Well, I think that, you know, not painting the full picture to the client is something that, you know, everybody can be a little bit guilty of at certain times. I think the main thing is when the broker doesn't actually have the experience and doesn't know it exists. So I'll give you an example. Not every single bank operates in the broker channel. So what that means is that we can't submit mortgages to every single bank that exists in Canada. So there are some niche banks where there might be some products out there that are a perfect niche for one of your clients. So a lot of brokers will tell a client that, hey, you know, you can't finance a sixplex property in the residential banking channel, because they can't finance a sixplex property in the residential banking channel. But there might be a residential bank outside of the broker channel who is willing to do it. So I think not disclosing products that maybe they themselves don't have access to is a practice I wouldn't recommend. And I think if you want to take your mortgage business to the next level, you have to know what exists outside of your realm of options and have people in those positions you can refer out to if that is indeed the right thing for your client.
Really interesting stuff. Jacob, thank you for your insight today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Jacob Perez is a partner and mortgage agent at Synergy Mortgage Group. And I was just trying to get a little bit more texture, color, insight on how it worked for mortgage brokers. It can be a really important piece of the home financing puzzle. Stay with us. Coming up next, how commission-free brokerages, stock brokerages like Robinhood, actually make their money. This will surprise you. Personal finance expert Preet Banerjee will be here. Listen, I do a show called CityLine. I just came home from taping the latest episode. It's so fun to be back in a proper TV studio. It is a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. Check out cityline.tv, and there's tons of fantastic content there about how to live a great life, including when it comes to your money.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Robin Hood. He, it's a dude, is not only a mythical character immortalized in film and even theater. It is also the name of a U.S. financial services company and brokerage that is known for a number of things, but in particular, its commission-free trade of stocks. Now, it's known for that because so many of its users have been trading stocks wildly over the course of the past 9 months or so. But if Robinhood isn't charging for trades, how exactly are they making their money? It's actually something called order flow, which I love that I have absolutely no idea what this means. Someone who does is Preet Banerjee. He is a personal finance expert. He is Preet Banerjee on YouTube, and he joins us now from Toronto. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How are you?
Order flow. What is order flow, and why would someone want to buy it?
Yeah, great question. And the answer is that this is what makes commission-free trading in the United States a possibility. So normally what happens is if you have an online discount brokerage account and you place an order to buy or sell a stock, you would think that it gets routed to an exchange. And about half of the time it does, and an exchange will try and match you up with someone who wants to take the other side of that trade. But the other half of those trades actually get routed to what are called market makers. And a market maker, their function is to provide liquidity to a market so that your trades execute quickly. And what they'll do is they will actually pay the discount brokerage to say, hey, we will pay you if you send your customers' orders this way, we will execute them. And so they make the payment to the brokerage. So the brokerage's revenue, instead of a trading commission per trade that you would normally see, they say, well, it's going to be free to you, customer, and we'll get our revenue from the market maker. And the market maker is able to do this because they make their money by the difference between the bid and the ask spread of securities that are trading in the market. So they kind of like scalp the in-between spread between the bid and ask. It's a very low margin business, but when you do it at huge scale, we're talking hundreds of millions of shares of execution, these little fractions of pennies add up to big money.
Why would Robinhood do this? Are they the only one that does this? Are they the biggest player that, that does this? Were they the first to do this?
Yeah, they instigated it. And the real big sort of legacy brokerages in 2019, basically at the same time, we're talking like TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, Schwab, they all said, yep, we're going zero commission as well, because they saw how this was such a winning proposition for Robinhood. Because, you know, on one hand, when it comes to financial inclusion, no account minimums, no costs, explicit costs to trade. They attracted so many customers, and they've made trading and access to do-it-yourself trading so easy, and some would say maybe too easy, that they've got millions and millions of customers that have opened up these accounts and are trading a lot. So if you compare the typical Robinhood customer, and if you go back to where things really blew up, it was at the beginning of the pandemic, and these what are called sort of pandemic day traders who were at home, they weren't able to do anything. They had stimulus checks. They put money into Robinhood because there was low barriers. And it's found that they're trading about nine times as frequently as sort of the users on the other legacy platforms in the U.S., such as E-Trade, 40 times as much as users on Schwab. And here's where it gets really interesting. 88 times as much for options versus the other brokerages. And this
my
is where
blood
they make,
goes cold.
Yeah. And so you can also sell order flow for options to market makers, and they pay a higher rate for that. And that's now where all the money is really being made.
You referenced the United States. This is not how it works here. Why not? Why doesn't it work like that here in Canada?
It's banned. Yeah. You are not allowed to have payment for order flow as a brokerage in Canada. Same with United Kingdom, same with Australia. And the reason is there is this conflict of interest because, you know, you're supposed to have the best execution price for your customers. You're supposed to act in their best interests. Mm. And so by having this payment for order flow model, it calls into question, you know, what is the incentive? Are the incentives for routing orders bigger than the incentive to execute at the best price? And a lot of money is being made. The small individual customer probably doesn't complain that much with respect to their own trades, because from their perspective, you know, what if their trade gets executed at $9.84 as opposed to $9.83 or whatever?
Yeah, because they saved $9.99 on that order if they were paying full carry.
Exactly. But where it is becoming more of an issue is the principle of it. And this goes to the overarching Wall Street versus the little guy. And so the little guy individually, they probably don't care about, you know, the they're saving money versus the other platforms. But in terms of the us versus them, they're saying, hey, we've got an issue with this on principle. So it's a very interesting dynamic.
How then does Wealthsimple do commission-free trading here in Canada? Well, they just have some like wealthy trust fund kids who are cutting checks. I'll pay for commission-free trading.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So commission-free trading in Canada can make sense if you think about the type of investor who is opening a trading account, mirroring what's happening in the States. And so the stocks, the individual stocks that people are hyping up and trading are all U.S. listed. Mm. And so with a no commission platform in Canada, because you can't make revenue from selling order flow, you have to turn to alternative sources of revenue. And one of those big sources can be foreign exchange spreads. And so what's an important distinction for anyone who has an account in Canada who's trading a lot of U.S. listed securities is to see whether or not your brokerage allows you to hold U.S. cash balances in your account, or if they force you every time you buy and sell a U.S. stock to convert it from Canadian to U.S. to buy it, and then force you to convert it from U.S. to Canadian when you sell it, even if you're going to immediately turn around and buy another U.S. stock, because the spread from this foreign currency round tripping is 3%. And that can actually be a lot larger than, you know, the $10 commission.
I want to talk about some of the unintended consequences here. In the U.S., and with Robinhood in particular, there was unbelievable volatility on what have been coined meme stocks, GameStop, AMC, just like tons of these names who have been having ridiculous volume and ridiculous highs and lows. It does seem like it has added a really unpredictable dynamic to trading.
Yeah, absolutely. And trading volumes have really exploded. Not only do you have just a huge new wave of brand new investors, but these new investors are trading at frequencies so much higher than everyone else that came before them. And part of that is because of this frictionless sort of environment where, you know, they're not sort of looking at any of these per trade costs and they're just saying, oh yeah, it's easy. I can in, I can go out. It's all mobile first. So these apps are designed first to be on your phone, desktop second. And so you can trade when you're, you know, on your transit, you know, during a break, at work, whatever it is, it's just so easy. And on top of that, it's all gamified. And so, you know, you open up an account, you make your first deposit, you have confetti exploding on your screen.
Right.
Right. And so you've got that dopaminergic response in your reward center in your brain. And every time you make a trade, all, you know, same thing. So it's encouraging more trading. And a lot of academic research says, you know, the more you trade, the worse it is for your performance. There's a paper called Trading is Hazardous to Your Wealth. And it's a huge drag.
You and I are not young. We're not old, but we are not young. So we recall the dot-com boom and bust. We recall the financial crisis of 2008. We know, because we've seen it, that there will be a market correction at some point. Given that we know this and history has proven that that will occur, how do these investors who've been benefiting from commission-free trading and have seen their investments go up and up and up, how do they fare when that inevitable correction arises?
That's a really interesting question. So, you know, with previous big downturns, there's this kind of dynamic equilibrium where people who get burned and they've been doing it themselves, sometimes they'll turn to different channels, maybe advice, and vice versa. People who have been working with advice, they go through a downturn, they say, well, I can lose money all by myself. I don't need to pay someone to lose money. And they switch to do it yourself. And so there's always been this sort of natural equilibrium where people shift between channels, especially when you have market downturns, because you're always trying to figure, well, what do I do differently because this didn't work? And so I think we're doomed to never really learn that lesson en masse. But the changing nature of the industry, I think it has changed forever because of the access to advice in non-traditional ways, such as online communities like Wall Street Bets, where you can get unofficial advice, good and bad, and everything in between from millions of people in this sense of community, which again breaks through this us versus them. It's like all of us in it together. Unfortunately, a lot of those people really, they're encouraging really risky behavior. You know, one last thing I want to squeeze in, because I think this is an interesting bit of trivia. Do you know who the pioneer of payment for order flow was? It was Bernie Madoff.
Really?
Yeah, wow. That's an interesting little nugget.
What an extraordinary legacy for Bernie, in addition to the other one that will still go unmentioned. Preet, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
Preet Banerjee, personal finance expert, YouTuber, podcaster, man about town. He was here to talk about how Robinhood can afford to offer commission-free trading. Answer, order flow. Fascinating stuff. That is our show for today. A thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, the simplest way to do that is to subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to moolala.ca. You can sign up for that newsletter. It comes once a month. You can also sign up to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms that you listen to other podcasts on. While you're there, leave us a review. If you've got questions, if you've got comments, anything you want to know, our email address, ask@moolala.ca. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry, Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala. On Facebook, I'm not on TikTok yet. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.